Hey everybody, welcome to Engaging the Phenomenon. Today we have a special guest. It's Jay from Project Unity. I've been waiting to have him here on the channel for a long time. It's finally happened, so welcome, Jay.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, James. Like a lot of people might not know, but you know, you and I have been speaking in the background a lot. And I mean, I contribute to your Ask UFO Twitter series for quite a while now, and I'm just really happy to be here with you. I have to admit, I do have a couple of disclaimers for you and everyone listening. So the first one is, sorry about the sunglasses, but the sun is like specifically coming right at me right now. So I've got my sunglasses on, and people are used to it on my channel. But for anyone listening, or most importantly watching, if my eyebrows fly off my face, it's because of Zoom. So Zoom likes to put a template of my eyebrows on top of my eyebrows for some reason. I don't know why, but if I move my head around in certain directions, sometimes you'll see my eyebrows fly off my face. I promise I'm not a projection. I am a real person, but Zoom seems to do some weird stuff to my face.
Yeah, well, you got the John Lennon look going
true. Right, yeah. Yeah. I'm like got the rock and roll kind of Morpheus look with these little sunglasses.
Yeah. Anyway, you got a guitar in the background there too.
Got the guitar in the background. Yeah. It's my little set, my little plants.
Yeah. So just for the people listening in, I mean, I want to say that 90% of the people on my channel or viewers and audience know who you are.
Yeah. We share a lot of audience.
Yeah. Cause you know, we do the UFOs and the consciousness. But just for people that may be new to you, how did you get into this work?
Yeah, so I mean, for me, it was a weird, synchronistic journey, which is why I kind of came into this through the consciousness conversation. Because to cut like quite a long story short, I've said it a few times, so I should be able to dilute it down, but. When I'm 26 years old now, and basically when I was around 19, 20 years old and I was doing university, I got into quite a big depression, mainly just because I didn't really have a grounding in anything, you know, spiritual or just, you know, I just didn't really know who I was as a person, still trying to find out who I was, as most people are at that age. And, I had this moment where essentially a lot of things went wrong in my life at once, and I went off looking for kind of answers and needing some sort of direction. And funnily enough, my dad actually introduced me to a book series. And this was kind of the first thing that got me into looking into consciousness, because this is where it all started for me. So my dad recommends this book series called Conversations with God by Neil Donald Walsh, who I was fortunate enough to actually interview not that long ago, which was a big deal for me because he was this kind of primary catalyst for shooting me off into the directions that eventually ended up in the UFO subject. But I read these books and they kind of kickstarted my journey into wanting to understand human consciousness. And this took, you know, this took me through a different, through a few different directions. That was kind of hard to say. It took me through a few different directions, basically through consciousness studies, through the spiritual and more kind of like hermetic texts, and also through a more scientific bent of quantum mechanics and models on consciousness that involve information exchange and non-locality and things that kind of seemed congruent with what I was learning at the time. So I started all of this off with jumping into different aspects of consciousness studies. And from that point, funnily enough, at a certain point a few years ago, it all kind of coalesced into what I would describe, I suppose, as another depression, because I'd got to a point where I kind of felt like, from a personal perspective, I'd taken in a lot of information. I'd come to my own personal conclusions about certain ideas in relation to reality and consciousness, but none of it really seemed to be attributable to my real life. Like it was just kind of all theoretical stuff that I had in my head. And I didn't really feel like, the reason I got into another depression was because I didn't really feel like I could do anything with this information. It was just all there. And I was like, okay, great. Well, I think I have some ideas about consciousness and life after death and all of this kind of stuff, but I don't know what to do with it. And so I literally in this room, sitting on my bed one day, just kind of asked the universe, in my own little way. I need something to do in this life that correlates to what I've been learning, that I can do physically, so that I actually feel like I'm living the thing that I feel is going on in my head. And funnily enough, it wasn't literally about a week later, less than a week later, when my best friend told me to watch a documentary, and it was the documentary Unacknowledged by Dr. Stephen Greer. And so at this point, didn't know who Dr. Stephen Greer was, didn't know about Unacknowledged, didn't really know anything about UFOs. I had a passive interest in this kind of stuff going through my life. If you were to take me aside at the age of like 17, 18 and say, hey, do you believe in UFOs? I'd have probably been like, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that there's something to that, but I don't know. You know, that would have been my response at that point. So I was never really a skeptic, but I was never engaged in looking into this subject until we watched this documentary. So I sit down and, you know, I watch Unacknowledged, and it's got all this military testimony. And, you know, I was nodding my head and going, wow, okay, well, this seems to be quite legit. Obviously, at that point, having no idea that there was such a backlog of historical information from military testimony to pilots, all that stuff. So this was my first introduction, and I was impressed. You know, I was like, wow, this seems really serious. And then when it got to the end of the documentary, that's when he brings in the whole component of CE5 and consciousness contact. And that for me was such a link in the chain for me, like instantaneously, because it felt like it was exactly what I had been asking for when I was sitting on my bed that week prior going, hey, look, I need something in this life that is, you know, attributable to what I've learned through consciousness. And I need something to do with this. And then suddenly, you know, less than a week later, I've got this guy on this documentary saying you can use your consciousness to, initiate contact situations. And that had never occurred to me before then. I mean, I guess in some way I had imagined, you know, consciousness, yeah, you can probably reach out into what we would call the afterlife. And I believe that people that were actually successful at channeling and all that kind of stuff were probably doing that kind of thing, entering into the stream of consciousness. And so that idea was there, but the idea of actually using it to initiate a form of contact with an off-world intelligence, that had literally never really entered my mind. So when he said this, it just kind of clicked for me. And so from that point onwards, I just went out into my back garden outside this window and started looking up at the stars. And, you know, I had meditated. I knew how to meditate to some degree before then. So I would get myself into a calm state of mind and, you know, look up at the stars. And I started seeing really weird things. And, you know, I was a sky watcher anyway. I'd always loved to look up at the stars throughout my entire childhood, and I'd never seen the kind of things that I was starting to see in the sky. And so that really did solidify for me that this type of contact modality through consciousness is actionable. And then that did eventually, after a couple of months of consistently going out and seeing things like white orbs traversing and flashing and, you know, doing things that were not typical of satellites, I ended up having very, very vivid experiences with orange orbs of light, which were completely undeniable experiences. You know, there was no way to brush them aside as some misidentification of a lanterns or flares or drones. They were very real, very in your face, and that really changed my life. And it was at this beginning period where I was going out and I was trying to make contact that I set up Project Unity. And you know, I was really at the beginning of Project Unity. I was just taking my phone out, putting it onto a tree branch in the middle of the forest, like deep in the forest where nobody could hear me talking and go like, what the hell is this guy talking about? And I just talked to the camera about my ideas around consciousness, about my ideas around the fact that contact through this type of modality is real. You know, and that really did start the journey. And from that point, I've gone off and I've been lucky enough to network and make connections with people like yourself and like with all these other researchers in the community. And yes, somehow Project Unity has clicked together into a relatively cohesive idea. But it started off with just me wanting to tell people, hey, look, I've had these experiences. I can't fully explain them, although I know that it comes from the ability for human consciousness to interact outside of just this, you know, fleshy vehicle that we're driving around. So that really is the beginning of it. So I thought I could condense it down from a long story to a short one, but I've still been talking for a while, so I'll let you say something now.
that's great. That's what you're here for. This is an interview. I'm here to have my listeners hear what you have to say. I value what you say. I think you're one of the leading edge innovative researchers, the future of the community.
Thank you.
Because you're here talking about the UFO subject, but probably one of the more important aspects of it is the consciousness aspect of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think as we go down the road with the UAP or UFO issue, you know, of course there's going to be nuts and bolts. I don't think the nuts and bolts is disconnected from the consciousness component. And some people try to separate it into these categories. And, you know, I think really it's, you know, just like my friend Exo Academia, and he has the podcast Point of Convergence, you know, yeah. Consciousness is that hub where all these things intersect. And I think eventually they are going to find the kind of equation for consciousness down the road. But like what you were saying with, you know, contact and the consciousness, the thing I like about CE5, and, you know, that's Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, human initiated contact with UFO intelligence. One of the reasons I think it's so important is that it's where the rubber meets the road. So you have like remote viewing is like, wow, that's really cool. And you can get some really, you know, good hits on targets. You know, you can say where it's like, okay, wow, that there's no coincidence there. But what with CE5 is more tangible. You know, there are physical, as far as we can tell, objects appearing in response to consciousness intention. You know, so I think that has a higher tangibility value than even remote viewing. And I think that's going to become apparent in the future. You know, not that remote viewing is any less valid, but, you know, that idea of where consciousness meets physical reality is right there, laid on the table with the CE5 work. Go ahead, you gotta say something?
No, I was just gonna say that I guess one of the big differences, like you were saying about rubber meeting the road, is the fact that you can't really record, film remote viewing and show the evidence of that interaction. Obviously there are ways of presenting that evidence, but when it comes to CE5, if you're fortunate and you have, you know, good cameras and the ability to record your group CE5 or your solo CE5, then you can have, you know, vivid visual evidence of what's going on. And so I guess that's one big key difference, is you do have this visual perspective to this visual side of it, which people want to see. People want that kind of experience. You know, it changes them when they see that.
Yeah. I mean, if anything's going to prove to you that, you know, consciousness extends beyond the body, this is, you know, CE5 and, you know, with a group or by yourself having some of these encounters, you know, after you have a genuine experience, there's going to be zero question in your mind that consciousness plays a big role in not even just the UFO phenomenon, but the nature of reality. You know, going back to some of your story, you're talking about how you went through these depression stages. And, you know, it's really interesting, actually, in the Theravadin Buddhist insight maps, they talk about those stages, and it's called the dark night of the soul or the dukkha jnanas. And, you know, even though people may feel down at the time, those are catalysts for transformation. So it's actually an insight awakening stage. So that slump or depression is actually, you know, not always a bad sign, not always that it's pleasant, but it's part of a transformation.
Well, and it's a difficult one to get your head around as a human being, because you're in the trenches of experience. But, like, you know, essentially, yeah, well, you can't have a valley without a mountain, and up without a down, a hot without a cold. So, like, you know, we are literally in that experience field. Whether higher levels of experience are like this, what we do know is down here there is duality and contrast. But without that duality, you literally would not be able to know what you are, because you would have nothing to compare yourself to. So, you know, it's easy to talk about that. Guarantee you the next day, if I stub my toe, I'm going to be going, oh my God, it's the worst day ever. But yeah. But we recognize that these things that happen to us in our lives, especially if you do enter into the type of lifestyle that promotes meditation and some level of self-reflection, you do see, oh, okay, well, yeah, that was a bad situation, but it led to this, to this, to this, to this. And when you dissect your life, everyone listening to this, if they dissect their life and look back, they'll see those moments, you know, those moments that they felt were at the time tremendously negative, but yeah, lead to positives in the outcome.
Yeah. It's pretty incredible. Yeah. I also wanted to just remark on, like, one thing that I found in my own kind of path, I guess you want to say, my own journey, is that some of the consciousness studies are really good for getting an intellectual understanding of kind of the nature of reality. But in my experience, like the meditation and kind of exploring consciousness, in my experience, yoga, Buddhism, those kind of things really help with the experiential side.
Yeah.
And if you combine those, I mean, you're really,
yeah,
that's, you're going to have a transformation basically. But just for people listening, I know you've probably talked about it a few times. I've heard you talk about it a few times. But your orange orb experience, do you want to explain that for the viewers?
Yeah, totally. So, this series of events took place within the space of about a month, because I had four experiences with these orbs, and I haven't seen them since, although some of that will be down to the fact that I haven't been as disciplined and going out and doing this kind of CE5 work as much as I probably should. But I've been caught up in, you know, how it goes. You get caught up in the rat race of research and interviews and networking, and you lull in some of your things. I know you're very good with your meditation and everything, so you'd be much more disciplined than I would be. But I've kind of lulled a little bit, so I guess that'd be why I haven't seen them again. But the experiences with orange orbs. So when I started doing this type of, at the time I would call it CE5, and I have to admit, I look for some different terminologies now because it's a little bit of a controversial buzzword, CE5.
Cognitive human interface.
CHI. I was literally going to say, I said to my mate the other day, you know what? I'm going to start calling it cognitive human interface, because that's what it's called.
I've been thinking about that. Yeah.
It makes sense as well. I mean, cognitive, conscious, human self-explanatory interface, exchanging, communicating. I mean, it's a good breakdown of what the components of CE5 are. So yeah, CHI protocols or something like that. But, the fact that I will tell people about the orbs, but the fact that it's called Qi, like the breakdown, so cool. Of it, it's, yeah, like, come on, man, that's not accidental.
I practice Qigong too.
Nice. Cool. So yeah, I mean, that's something that I probably lean towards now, calling it something else, because of the obvious stigma and controversy. But yeah, I started off doing this type of thing. I was seeing a lot of white orbs traversing over the skies, flashing multiple times as they traverse over. So kind of taking out of the equation the possibility of it being an iridium flare, which only happens, once as it transits across. And so I was seeing a lot of them in a high frequency. And like I said to you before, I was a sky watcher. I used to love looking at the stars anyway. So seeing this level of frequency of white orbs and seeing these bizarre kind of light behaviors where it was flashing and it felt like it was in connection with my thoughts, I'd be like, oh, hello, and it would go flash, and it's like, whoa, hang on a second, yeah, I said hello and you just flashed at me, can you do that, yeah, again, flash, and yeah, so it's like, okay, something's happening here. So that was what I was seeing for a good, I don't know, a couple of months, I guess. It's been a long time since this all happened, and so it's a little bit hazy, but it was at least a couple of months that I was going out. And it was in the summertime, so it was lovely and warm like it is now, which is actually why I'm going out and doing it more often. It's just nice and warm in the evenings. But yeah, I was seeing these white orbs, and I saw a couple of other things. Like I saw like a very, very bright, you could say it was a comet, but it looked like a blimmin' firework. It was crazy. Like, just strange things that I hadn't really seen before in the sky. But then the first time I saw these orbs was spectacular. The introduction to it was bizarre and still hard to explain. So I was outside in my back garden, and I'm actually getting someone who's really good at art in the UFO community to do a painting of my experience, which I'm really excited about, because I want to see it for myself and see if it matches up to what I saw. But I was standing in my back garden. I was looking towards my house. So I was kind of like facing this way, looking towards my house, crystal clear night. And I was out there getting into a meditative state, sending out thoughts with the intention of having some sort of contact. And the first thing I saw was this bright white flash on the right-hand side of my sky. And I've seen flashes of light before, but this was static and there didn't seem to be any sort of object attached to it. I just see a flash. I looked flashbulb. Yeah, flashbulb, but it was repeating itself every second and a half, but it was staying in the same area of space. So just flash, flash, flash. And I was watching that, and I hadn't seen specifically that kind of thing before. So I was staring at it, and I was, sending out thoughts saying hello and thank you and all of that. And that must have been going on for a few minutes, to the point, at least to the point where I was like, okay, well, I'm going to keep panning around. This is great that you're here and flashing. I really appreciate it, but I'm going to keep panning around the sky, see if there's anything else to look at. When I took my eyes off of this flash and turned to the left-hand side, I saw this cloud, and I literally did a double take, because I looked up, I looked back, and then I went, hang on a second, and I looked around at it again. And this cloud it's very hard to describe, and I still struggle with it, but it was like, it's like the components of it were staticky. The actual cloud itself was very agitated. It looked like there was energy and static, and it was popping and fizzling. It was very hard, not as vivid as TV static, but like a condensed version of TV static, where it was still a cloud. It looked like a cloud, but there was a shimmer, like a staticky shimmer around it that I'd never seen a cloud exhibiting before. So I was staring at this cloud like, what the hell is that? And if this is my house and this is the cloud's drifting over this way. So eventually it's going to go past my house. That's the trajectory it was on, like sideways across. And I was back here looking towards my house. It comes across, and literally as it gets to pretty much in alignment with my house, it does a complete right angle turn. So it starts going this way towards me, until it's eventually going to be above my head. It wasn't coming down towards me, but it just suddenly changed complete 90 degrees until it was then floating over in alignment and towards me. And so I was just like, okay, like my heart skipped a beat. I was quite freaked out because this thing was in the atmosphere. It wasn't just a little white orb up in space doing something. It was here, and it did freak me out a little bit. My heart skipped, and this cloud came floating over, and literally as it got above my head, I mean, it still sounds so bizarre. No matter how long I've been telling this story and all the other things I've heard in the community since I've been doing this, it's still like I can feel people going, you know, like, is that even possible? Yeah. And it's really hard, but I promise this really did happen to me. This cloud came above my head and literally melted in like a space of a second and a half. It just went, just fizzled out. And inside this cloud was a triangular formation of, my ballpark is roughly 25 to 30 orange orbs of light in a tight triangle formation. This is like literally, the cloud just melted and this was inside it. So now looking back, I have to imagine some sort of cloaking mechanism, I guess, was the cloud, like some sort of generated cloaking mechanism. And then it decided to just shut that mechanism off for a moment and let me see what was inside it. That's the only thing I can imagine. And yeah, it was this triangle formation of orbs, and it didn't stop or, you know, beam me up or anything like that. It just, cloud dissipated, triangle was in there, and the triangle just kept on its trajectory until it was off in the distance. So I turned around and, you know, watched it go off into the distance completely silently. And that was the first time I'd ever seen them. First person I phoned, it was like 11 o'clock. First person I phoned was my mom. Just phoned my mom up like, mom, you're not going to believe what I've just seen. And she was with my stepdad, and they were both talking about this, like, oh my gosh, like, you know, he sounds like he's really, you know, like he's quite visibly shocked by what he's seen. And funnily enough, a little segue, my mom actually looked up my area. She typed in my area where I live in Nottingham. I'm not going to say specifically where, but she typed in my area and orange orbs and like UFO and some keywords. And she's not a UFO researcher. This was her first introduction to something bizarre like this. And she actually found an article that was reported from my street like 8 or 10 years back about orange orbs flying over the sky. And that was so weird for me because it was literally on this very road that I'm situated on. Someone like 8 years back actually reported seeing these orange orbs flying over. But that was the first time I'd seen them. I can tell you about the other ones, but yeah, that was the first.
Yeah, that's incredible. And you know, I think, you know, experiences like that it changes you, and they're not random. They just happen to be by. This
happened to be there. Yeah. No. You know,
this is intended.
It was the fact that I'd obviously been out there trying to make this type of contact beforehand. It wasn't like I'd just gone out and I was having a cigarette or something and I was looking up at the sky. No, I was out there with, you know, 2 months behind me of continually going out and seeing strange things. And this just felt like a massive step up from what I'd seen before. Yeah. You know?
And I think, you know, for people that are interested in contact work or have been doing it, you know, hang in there. Cause again, you know, you may have, you know, many nights, maybe a little bit of activity, but eventually it's going to happen where you just have a kind of over the top in your face contact experiences. You know, if you're going out with a genuine intent, that's transformative. And, you know, luckily for me in quite a few of those circumstances that, you know, I was able to have family members there to witness the thing.
Yeah.
And to me, that was just like,
your experience is incredible. I mean, the sky basically just lit up in every sort of way with you.
Yeah. And I had several family members there, like, like, what the hell is going on?
What is going on here?
You know, just, that, you know, that's incredible for me. Yeah. I couldn't ask for a better scenario. Yeah. I know not everybody is that lucky. So I don't want to rub it in people's face here.
but about intention as well, real quick, like it's a really difficult one to balance that because, you know, I've had very vivid, incredible experiences and then I've gone out and I've, you know, tried to do the same thing and nothing's happened. And I've kind of come to the conclusion that it's a very, very delicate level of intention. And if you're, for example, out there and you're just kind of like, you believe it's real, but you're just expecting to see lights and you just want to see something. And there's not really that peace or that love or that grounding positivity, but more of a kind of like urgency of like, oh, come on, I want to see something. It's not going to happen. Or at least it doesn't happen for me.
Yeah. It's, yeah. The genuine intent of truly wanting to connect and, you know, having some kind of purpose beyond just, you know, I want to be entertained.
Yeah.
For everybody, it's going to be different. I mean, sure. If you're curious, if you know, UFOs exist and you're curious if these kind of consciousness things exist, you'll probably get a response. And you know, it's unpredictable, and we have to take into the fact that, you know, half of this equation lies on the phenomenon, and we can't really assume their reasons or even their response. So even if you're out one night and they don't respond, you know, possibly there's a possible time lag where you don't reach them immediately, even though there is probably a quantum process. You know, your message might not be received for a day or two, for all we know. You know, we don't really understand that aspect of it. I mean, there is the instantaneous quantum entanglement part of the equation, but you know, again, there's a lot of unknowns on the aspect of the phenomenon. So that's also something to keep in mind. But getting back to the intention, yeah, it's important you kind of level out intention versus expectation.
Yeah,
you know, if you're too caught up in expectation, you're not present in the moment to kind of let your intentions freely drift through the universe in a way like that,
which is so hard for the materialistic skeptics when you say, but when you get your camera out to try and record, nothing really happens. It's like, of course it doesn't happen when you're trying to record. But unfortunately, when you're genuinely focused more on getting something on a phone or on a camera, more focused on that than you are on doing what you're doing, it seems really difficult to get them to come out and say hello. So, you know, I've kind of tried to set my camera up sometimes and put it to the side and leave it kind of filming the sky and then just walk away from it and just hope something turns up on the camera if I'm doing this kind of stuff. But I found it very difficult to actually get something on camera because I find that when I'm out there and I'm holding a camera, I'm just way more focused on the camera than I am on actually what I'm trying to do. So people don't like that, but it is true. It is true.
1,000,000%. And there is the aspect of, well, does the phenomenon want you to record it?
Right.
So I think there's both at play because, you know, I got a night vision camera recently and, you know, again, it's so distracting to have it because you're, The eyebrow thing just happened.
Dude. I just saw it. I saw it with my peripheral vision.
Dude, is that a trick?
I'm telling you, yeah. People have literally started calling it Cybrows, PSY brows on my YouTube channel. So
it's got to be.
The Cybrow stroke again. Yeah, I know. I am Project Bluebeam.
you're a non-human intelligence projection.
Yeah, I'm just a projection. Yeah.
But getting to that, if you have a camera or any really, you know, the field work tools are great when you're trying to work at them and bring it into the 3D and interact and record and stuff. And stuff does happen. And again, you can record. It's not impossible to record, but
no,
you really put that stuff aside, just go out. And there's no, you're not thinking about that. You're just focused on the process and the true intention of just going out there trying to connect with this other intelligence for, you know, positive, I guess you can say, effects, you know, for, you know, mutually beneficial reasons. You know, you're going to have a much greater response, in my opinion, both in volume. So, you know, more of the time. And then likely a deeper experience because you're more deeply engaged in the actual contact work itself.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, so I completely understand that. And it is frustrating. And what I'm going to have to do is something what Rob Freeman has. So I'm just going to have a tripod set up. I'm going to put that to the side and even, you know, have maybe somebody man the technology that's kind of involved in the process. But is able to maneuver it or something, or and then just focus on the work itself.
I'd love to have Rob Freeman's setup. I think he's got the most extraordinary camera optics setup I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, weapon of mass detection. That thing is just incredible, man.
It is incredible. You know, I was on a road trip recently with my buddy Jean-Luc and my best mate who's not involved in the UFO community, but he loves listening to stuff, and we traveled to South Wales to meet Kaz Clark, who's this woman who says that she experienced this this triangular pyramid style craft in the small town of Penturk in Wales, and there was this major military operation. It's a whole thing. I did an interview with her. So if anyone wants to listen to that, it was a recent interview I did on my channel. So you can check that out. But we went down there recently, literally just the other day. I just got back and we had a great time, but we also did a CE5. We did a group CE5. And I caught a flash on camera, but you can hear me in the video, and I'll put the video up. I've already posted it on Twitter. You can hear me in the video saying about the ones doing maneuvers, but unfortunately, they weren't turning up on my little camera on my Samsung camera. I didn't have any night vision or anything. So you see this flash of light from one of them powering up. But what happened was awesome. Like, because I've never seen, it's this weird like middle ground thing that I've never experienced. So I've seen white orbs traversing and flashing and doing that kind of stuff. I've also seen orange orbs doing incredible things, but I haven't ever seen white orbs doing directional changes. That was one thing I'd never seen. I'd seen them coming across the sky, and I'd never seen an abrupt directional change. And me and this girl, Vicky, we were sitting down in Kaz's back garden, dead of night, beautiful starlit Welsh countryside sky, so no light pollution at all. And, things have been coming over, and me and her were sitting down, and I was like, you know, I've seen these things coming over, I've seen them flashing, but I've never seen them doing directional changes that I would, you know, consider to be really abrupt and out of the ordinary. And she was like, yeah, me too. You know, I've seen them doing all these strange flashing of light, but I've never seen that. And then people were going, oh, look, there's another one coming over. And so we all kind of like looked up and, got the laser out and people were watching it. And this white orb literally came down over the house and then just stopped and went back up and did a snake. And then it kind of started going around and it was just doing complete directional changes. And you can hear me on the video going, oh my God, it's maneuvering. This is what we were just talking about. And it's the fact that we were just talking about it, James. And then it happened.
That's a true CE5. When there's no question in your mind and there's an obvious interaction with what your consciousness is doing.
You're just going to have to get used to it, James.
Oh, that's cool though, I guess, right? That's a trademark The Jay trademark. We're going to do an Ask UFO Twitter video on that.
Yeah. Or like, why do Jay's eyebrows fly off his face when he's doing interviews? What is going on here?
Does that do that when you have no sunglasses too?
Yeah, it does. Like, literally, look, watch this. Like,
oh my God.
It's what it's doing is my eyebrows will look thicker to you than they actually are. It puts like a template of my eyebrows on top of my eyebrows for some reason. I don't know. It's only Zoom. Like Skype and Google Meetup and all the others are fine. But on Zoom, my eyebrows just kind of flop around.
Is there a setting on your Zoom? I've tried.
I don't know what it is. I think that because on Zoom you can apply filters to your face that track.
Yeah.
Like it tracks, like you can put like party hats on your head and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's tracking my eyebrows. I don't know why though. Yeah. So I apologize for all of your listeners or viewers who are seeing my eyebrows fly off my face. It's become quite a normal thing on my channel. Everyone's very used to it.
Yeah, that's so cool though. I mean, in a funny way, you know, you have your own trademark.
I know, yeah.
Yeah, but no, when you have that kind of direct correlation between what you're thinking and what your intentions are, and then the phenomenon responds in that kind of way, that's what we like to call in the contact community a lock-on.
Yeah.
Of sorts. Not many of the new people or people use it anymore, but that's like an old school 1990s vintage CSETI stuff. But yeah, man, that's incredible. You know, I had a period where I was seeing stuff like that on a nightly basis. And for me, sometimes the way that the contact manifests is I'll have like a theme, like where something like that will be most of what I see for several months. And I think it's literally because it's kind of what I'm expecting to see in the back of my mind. So I see it happen once. And then after that, I happen to see it often after that, every time I go out, it's, you know, or most of the time when I go out. So that's something I really do want to, I hope to catch on film, because that's, you know, again, no great explanation for that, especially because I've had it where it's you know, the area in two different ways. More than two different ways, but these two different distinct ways are very compelling. Is that the sky in that area is completely blank, and then it starts to light up and light up and light up, and there's a huge ball there that came out of nowhere, and it's stationary, and then it begins to move, and then it will stop, and stuff like that. And, you know, and or the opposite, where I'll see a stationary thing, like it looks like a star, and it's literally there, and I'm watching it for a few minutes. And then when I start to focus in on it, I'm like, is that a star? And then it begins to move, you know, and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
And then it will disappear, like stop and then light up and then disappear, stuff like that. And I really appreciate the kind of anomalies in that way, because I can mark them in the unidentified category confidently, saying unidentified with the likelihood of you know, another intelligence. So that's helpful.
What's your best working theory, hypothesis, idea about what these things are in terms of what we're interacting with C5, the white orbs, the orange orbs? Have you got any, I mean, obviously you don't know, but have you got any kind of like leanings towards something specific?
Man, that's tough.
I know. I've been thinking about it as well.
Well, because I think that we're dealing with several intelligences.
Yeah, for sure.
I've noticed this through even my own experiences. I'll just say it. During one of the lock-ons I had, where I was in my house, I'm cleaning. It was like just the day after I had this crazy, something like a near-death experience. It was a trauma-induced OBE. Because it was in this car accident, whatever. I had this whole crazy experience. I'll explain it sometime. It was very deep and insane.
You've gone into this to some extent, right? Because I swear I've heard about it.
Yeah. But I've never told the whole story yet. But after that event, the next day, I was in my room, I'm cleaning, and all of a sudden, I get like, there's a voice that I can feel and hear through my entire body. If that's the only way I can describe it. And it was not my voice. And it was these beings, and they told me they were extraterrestrials. Okay.
Wow.
And But as soon as I heard the voice, they said, go outside. Okay. But as soon as I heard the voice, there was this instantaneous download lock on where they told me that they were extraterrestrials and that they had good intentions for us, basically. I mean, they were kind of trying to communicate that they're like our friends or family. That's literally the message I got. But they did tell me in that they were ET. And that's when I went outside and I heard this humming. And just over the tree line, there's a physical craft that's shaped almost like an octagon.
Wow. Wow.
It's like a dark gray, almost black metal. And it was humming and I had the whole electricity through my body and I'm freaking out. And I, you know, it disappeared. And then it went across to the lake, across the street from my driveway, and putting on this light show. And that's when I ran in my house and I grabbed my family. I said, get out here now. They're here. And they're like, who's here? I said, just come outside.
They are.
Well, like, you know, I couldn't think of anything. Yeah, yeah. I said, just come outside. And, you know, we were outside for almost a half an hour with these different crafts appearing and the swirling lights. But so here's the thing I want to make the distinction here is that these were physical crafts. These were not orbs. These were physical crafts, like your typical UFO that you'd see in like old school UFO movies. And these beings, again, whether I can believe it or not, you know, I can't say definitively what they're telling me is true, but they communicated that they were extraterrestrials. So I guess in some sense, I have to take their word for it.
Do you feel like they were being honest with you? Like,
yes, 100%, a million percent, because when that connection happened, it's a two-way connection and I could feel what they were feeling. Okay. And that's a lock on, like, it's like our minds were one, literally. Right. Our minds, emotion, thinking, feeling. And it was like an overwhelming joy. That's the only way I can describe it. And, and I go back and I think about experiences like that. And I wonder, you know, are they communicating this literally, or is it they're trying to tell me something in a way that I'll understand it? Because this, you know, this was a long time ago. This was many years ago. This was when I was researching, but I wasn't like, I guess you can say at that time, I wasn't reading like Jacques Vallée. I was reading Hynek and stuff. But so at that time, I didn't have a conception of extra dimensional, interdimensional, not so much. More my thinking was, okay, these are extraterrestrials. So I don't know if they were trying to communicate in a way where I was going to understand it.
Yeah.
Or they were just communicating a representation and that's how I interpreted it, because it's my current level of understanding.
Well, it makes me think about something that Terence McKenna once said when he was, you know, deep in the Amazon basin, taking ayahuasca and things like that. And he met an entity in this space that said to him, you know, we've disguised ourselves as extraterrestrials so as to not alarm you with what's really going on.
and that may very well be true.
Yeah.
but there are other experiences I have had that were distinct from that.
Right.
In which if I had to just guess, roll the dice, I'd say they're extra dimensionals.
Yeah.
I'm going to do a video on that, extra dimensionals, and something I've called hyperspatial intelligence.
Ooh, I like that.
It's the same thing as extra dimensional, but it's to communicate the kind of framework of hyperspace.
Yeah.
Where it is a part of physics. It's just a part of physics that's beyond our current understanding. Yeah. So we call it hyperspace, but it's space as we know it. But it's, you know, they use the term hyperspace to try to indicate that it's beyond, it's just like the word supernatural.
Yeah.
Everything in the physical universe and non-physical universe is natural. We just call it supernatural because we don't understand it yet. You know, and as soon as we understand it, it's just going to be part of nature. You know,
what was that term that you threw towards Lou Elizondo? That was like spatial temporal translation or something like that.
Yes. Yeah.
Was that right? Is that what it was? Yeah. Oh, nice. I didn't think I was get that. What is that? What is that? What do you know about that? Why did you ask him that question?
Because it was on slide seven.
Oh, is it?
Slide seven. Yeah. I spoke to Hal and I asked him, and Hal said, because Lou said, you're going to ask somebody more qualified. He said, ask Hal. So I asked Hal, and he said, it's like, basically, I mean, teleportation slash time travel. You know, okay. The way he said it was that the spatial temporal translation is being able to appear, disappear, and reappear in another space and time.
Right. You know? Okay.
Yeah. So, and but you have to think of the implications of that possibility.
Right? Yes.
Like, what does that even mean? If you dissect that, you break it down, and you start to contemplate what that even means. And if you can do that, what else can you do? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. At that point, all bets are off with the capabilities that you've got.
Yeah. Whether they're coming from a different dimension, a different time.
Different time. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
These are some of the fascinating questions. And I hope, you know, as, you know, disclosure opens more, we're going to get, you know, mainstream scientists asking more of these questions.
Yeah.
And hopefully more information will be released from, you know, the Pentagon and maybe other countries that have information, and we'll start to get clearer pictures and indications of what, you know, what we're dealing with. And for people who are confident and brave enough and to do something like contact work in CE5, I mean, there's nothing like getting it through your own experience, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's the experiential level. There's the intellectual level, which I think it is important, but for me, the experiential level has been more important just because that's been my experience.
It's like the theory and the practical. They're both useful. Like, you need the theory, right, and then you need the practical, and the CE5 is the practical. Like, it's, you know, it's all of that understanding of, you know, quantum entanglement or consciousness, whichever way you come from this, whether it's spiritual and it coalesces into this practical experience. Yeah.
Yeah, and I wanted to do something like a video called something like CE5 and the observer effect, you know, because there's something of like the observer effect, like the double slit experiment and stuff that happens, you know. But again, so let's talk CE5 and the terminology. You know, the terminology has, and you know what? I love the term for years, but it's like self-defeating in a sense nowadays. And we all know the big elephant in the room is the controversy is because of Dr. Stephen Greer. And, you know, he hasn't made it easy to really use that like term us. Anymore, you know? Yeah, there's people like us who understand the work and who don't necessarily agree with all his conclusions and even his attitude and his approach, but still know that the work is, you know, useful and true. But also there's a better way to represent the work than he's doing. And I think his vision is great. You know, the vision of, you know, kind of like the universal peace thing where you want to have a citizen's outreach to these other intelligences in a peaceful way. That, of course, that makes sense. You know, but then he exclusively defines it as extraterrestrial, you know, which may be his experience. And I don't want to discount his experience, but, you know, I think with CE5 or, you know, let's call it contact work or, you know, cognitive human interface is that, you know, we're probably dealing with more than just extraterrestrial intelligences when we're doing this work. So I think there needs to be a new framework rolled out where it's more open-ended, you know.
Have you ever had anyone, I mean, obviously like people online, but I mean, maybe someone who's claiming to be an intelligence or anyone in that upper level come out of the woodwork and tell you not to do CE5, like to warn you?
No, actually. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of these, you know, I've spoken to people in the Invisible College about it. The only thing that one of them told me was don't touch the orbs if you see them.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been within a few feet of them where I could have, but I didn't, you know, I was just like, almost like stuck in place. But no, they actually, you know, and one of them I was talking to and they said, you know, they completely think that the work of contact work is basically genuine, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, drop all the labels and drop all the assumptions. The core of the work, being able to initiate contact with a non-human intelligence, is genuine. And they actually proposed an idea and they were going to bring it back to the Invisible College and possibly talk about it at one of their upcoming meetings. That was before COVID. I don't know if they actually did that, but I know they sent it off an email chain. But I think that none of them have ever said don't do it.
Yeah.
The one of the funny things is, though, like I'll talk about what contact work or CE5 is and say, do you think this? They're like, yeah. And I'll say everything that contact work is. And I'll say, what do you think about CE5? And they say, oh, I don't know. Because the association comes in there.
Yeah.
And now they're kind of like they have a knee jerk reaction.
Well, I guess maybe cognitive human interface is the unidentified aerial phenomena of CE5. So people are trying to distance themselves from UFO and all of the stigma attached to that. So maybe we need some new terminology for this because of the unfortunate stigma that's been created around CE5. And you know, maybe seeking new terminology is what's required. And you know, the academic community will get in more engaged with this. And I do think that with the progression in models through quantum mechanics that look at the kind of energetic nature of below the material, the kind of substructure of reality, that we will eventually come to a point where there's lots of white papers and academic papers written on, the actionability of consciousness in a non-local capacity. I mean, there's already tons of those types of papers. There's already loads of physicists writing that kind of stuff. But I do think it will become more easily translatable in the future. And in terms of a mainstream conversation about consciousness, at least within the realms of the narrative we're seeing unfold through the mainstream media, I'm not that optimistic. Like in terms of, you know, hearing CNN or Fox News say, oh, and you can also, you know, use consciousness. Like, I don't see that happening for a while, but I do expect the academic, arena to get more involved in that. And I'll tell you one thing real quick. I don't want to sidetrack too far off of CE5, but one thing that's really given me some hope is seeing Eric Weinstein getting involved. Man. My God, right? Right?
Yeah, I love it. I love it, man. And I'm gonna do a video on that soon, just like I did the Sam Harris one.
Yeah,
I'll tell you here, so I'll kind of detract from my video a little bit of what I was going to say, but nobody knew this. As everybody missed it in the community, but Eric Weinstein had Daniel Sheehan on his.
Oh no way! On the portal?
No, not on the portal. It was on what do you call it? Clubhouse.
Okay,
And this was a month before anybody knew about Danny Sheehan working with Elizondo.
With Elizondo, yeah.
And Sheehan said on that Clubhouse that he was representing Lou. Like a month before anybody knew, a month before, you know, Danny Silva's article or anything. And Eric Weinstein was having a meltdown because he knows Danny. He knows Danny and he trusts him. And he had no idea that Danny was big into this.
Was doing this. Yeah.
Yeah. So
he's very vocal on Twitter now.
I love it. Yeah, and let me tell you, Eric has been speaking to people that know stuff, like genuine.
Yeah. That wouldn't surprise me.
Invisible college people that have material evidence and are very smart. And Eric is listening.
God, I want to interview him so badly.
I know. There's conversations going on in the background. I know a few people who know him. I don't think I'll ever be able to get him on. But if one of us does, man, please.
I know, right? Tell me about it.
By all means, try every angle, because it's refreshing to see his outrage, because this is how every scientist should be acting.
Yeah.
Why, you know, I look his Lex Fridman talk. I was so impressed with how honest he was.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, he said, I was trained to call all this nonsense and the Pentagon swept the rug from under us.
Yeah.
And now I don't know what to think.
Yeah.
You know, that is so honest. And now he's calling for scientists to be publicly informed on this, so the scientific community can look at the evidence, you know, and that needs to happen. That's when this thing is going to go like through the roof.
Yeah.
This
is the thing. I really see him as such an outlier in the academic community right now. It's amazing. Cause like, you know, like you said, he's not just saying, oh, there could be something to this. He's pissed. Like he's genuinely on Twitter saying this is ridiculous. Like, you know, why are the scientific, arenas not engaged in this? Why is the government hidden this from us? And like you said, on that Lex Fridman, I think I clipped that bit as a quote, and I quoted it and I put it on Twitter because I was just like, here is a guy who is clearly, you know, one of the top tier intellectuals. He is so smart and capable. He has done so much in his time, and he's a well-respected, you know, academician. And here he is being honest. He's taken his ego. He's put it to the side. He's not saying this conflicts with my ideologies, and that's why I think it's nonsense. He's saying this conflicts with my ideologies, and now I have to rearrange what my ideologies are. And the government has done this to me, and I'm not happy about it. And I want answers. And that is, like you said, exactly the kind of response we should be getting from people, instead of having people like Seth Shostak, who are trying to say that the FLIR videos are two twin engines. And you know, it's like, I saw this report from recently with it was like him. It was Nick Cook. Much love to Nick Cook. Love that guy. And yeah. And Gary Nolan, I think it was those three in an article being quoted. And Seth was just saying one thing that I have, just to quickly sidetrack, it just frustrated me, because he said something along the lines of, OK, well, everyone's referring to these Navy pilots as if they're experts, but Navy pilots don't know how to distinguish what an alien craft is. And it's like, but hang on a second. But they do know how to distinguish every known aerial platform in the inventories of the world governments and private. They know everything in the sky, and they're saying they don't know what this is. And he's using that as an excuse of saying, yeah, like, oh, well, we don't know what alien craft look like, so these guys are no more professionals than I am. But it's like that's such a loose argument. And they ignore the data, they ignore the radius of data around that. And yeah, like, you know, power to Eric Weinstein and Sam Harris. I think they're the first of many.
Yeah, and the thing with Shostak is he's an astrophysicist. Yeah. He's not trained in FLIR technology. He's not trained as a pilot. He's not qualified.
Yeah.
The pilots are qualified to determine if something's unidentified or identifiable. That's their job. You know, like quite literally, they have to be able to distinguish objects in the exercise or battle station. So that's a non-argument. That's hyperbolic. Exactly. That's rhetoric. It's not, you know, and it's really quite literally meant to distract, because he can't honestly say that intellectually unless he's being dishonest with himself and in turn others. So that's
he's kind of like a stark contrast of Eric Weinstein and Seth. So you've got, you know, both of them are smart. There's no denying Seth's an intelligent man, but it's that very clear perspective of he doesn't want to let go of his models of how this should be done. You know, fast repeating radio bursts in space and the SETI program and all the stuff. He's been doing this for years, trying to find life in the universe. And the rug's been swept from under him, but he's just put his heels down and buckled down and gone, no, this is not right. Whereas, you know, someone like Eric has swallowed his pride and gone, hey, I was told that this was all BS, but now it doesn't look like it is. And that's very, you know, two very profoundly different ways of looking at this issue. And I know which one I prefer.
Correct. Yeah. And, you know, Sam Harris, I have literally, because, you know, I read his book Waking Up, and I've listened to him here and there, mostly on his meditation stuff, not as much of his other stuff, but you know, I'm big into the Dharma world, and he's in the pragmatic Dharma world, where it's kind of like more, you know, Western Buddhism, which is its own kind of thing upon itself, is where a lot in Western Buddhism you take the practice and kind of like the practical approach, and you do away with the dogma. That's just, you know, how it developed really in the West, at least, you know, because a lot of academics are involved with Western Buddhism, but not so much like the whole, you know, the cultural and the dogmatic aspect.
Yeah, I guess just, like a kind of intellectually refined version of of that thing.
You know, it's a boiled down version, and that's what we call Western Buddhism, I guess you can say. So Sam Harris, I was waiting for him since 2017. I figured I was like in 2019, 2020, I'm like, oh man, I hope he ends up talking about this just because it's in the media, you know? And so when he came out, I was just like, I was more than impressed, because I figured I was expecting him to say, oh, maybe there's something to this.
Yeah.
But dude, he's like,
well, you know, he's been approached
by the head of the CIA, a former head of the CIA, and somebody from the Naval Research Labs. And you know, there's a lot of classified stuff, and Naval Research Labs is like almost number one when it comes to classified stuff, you know, technology. And they have a big, because the Navy's one of the oldest, so they have huge budgets, and a lot goes to them. But yeah, the he was approached by them to have a Zoom conference, and they're telling him like, and he, you know, he says one shoe has dropped, the other hasn't quite dropped yet, but you know, they're, you know, behind the scenes, there's like a unanimous kind of agreement that, you know, whatever this technology is, it's not made by humans. And for somebody like him to come forward and say that, and basically they're communicating him with him to be able to communicate this as an influencer to the public.
Yeah.
That this is something, you know, don't get caught up in the conspiracies. Although some of them may be true, you know, realistically, that this has been hidden and stuff, but don't get caught up in the conspiracies. This is not something to panic about, but this is a reality that we're going to explore kind of thing. I think that was incredible to hear him talk about three times now, you know, three times he's come out and said this. And I'm interested to see, you know, what's going to happen, you know, going forward. Cause I don't think he's going to drop it. I think he's kind of going to go on, continue both pursuing it, maybe learning a few things and continue to entertain the idea and speak about it openly and hopefully get more intellectuals involved.
Yeah, I think he's going to hit him and Eric Weinstein are kind of like, in my opinion, the first two emerging catalysts that can spread out into the intellectual academic community. I mean, you do have other people that are interested, but Sam Harris, obviously, you know, extremely influential, and Eric Weinstein, he's kind of like he almost like the academic Joe Rogan with his podcast. So many people watch his podcast, and you know, you've got young people like Silicon Valley types who are getting into this, and then you've got people like me who are just trying to learn as much as I can and sometimes really straining me intellectually. I'm like, oh my god, I really want to understand what Eric is saying here, but I'm struggling now. But that's just proof of, you know, his brilliance. And you know, these people are front runners. They've emerged into the virtual space as academics with a lot of popular, you know, demographic behind them. Like, people are really supportive of them, and they echo out into a new generation, into a wider generation through the podcasts and stuff like that. So yeah, these guys are, you know, they would be my choices as well to try and get this stuff out. If I was thinking of who can I approach in the intellectual community who's already got a plug into the wider demographics, oh well, you know, people like Eric, people like Sam. And I said this on Twitter, and I'm pretty sure you commented, but I was just saying I'd love to have been a fly on the wall for that Zoom meeting. Oh, what was you said, know, to him?
I'm not sure. He's a former head of the CIA, so maybe John Brennan, maybe Woolsey, who knows? But I completely believe him. Somebody made the remark saying maybe somebody was yanking his chain a little. I do not think that's the case. I think these people are. I think Sam has a very high level of skepticism, as you know, as he is, and I don't think he's going to overstate something.
No,
on the opposite, he's
especially not with a subject like this. Yeah,
correct. Yeah. So, and you know what? These people are pioneers. You know, so major props to them, and also to Lex Friedman for continuously asking the questions. That hashtag we had, ask the question.
Ask the question.
You know, he's asking the question, and you know, he's another intellectual, so a lot of props.
Yeah, I've got a lot of love for Lex Friedman. Yeah, great guy.
It's great that they're you know, and I hope it's going to continue. And
I was just about to say, it's just the beginning, dude. It's just the beginning. I guarantee it. It's, you know, it's obviously this has been going on for decades. People have been researching it, but in terms of this modern emergence, we're looking at literally since 2017 for some people. Like, that's the beginning of this subject for some people. This really is just the beginning. You know, I do have issues with the narrative, even though I understand the necessity for there to be a kind of like a slow, soft rollout. The only reason that we're having to have a slow, soft rollout is because of decades of governmental secrecy. And so, like, I don't really want to let the government get away scot-free with this and go like, hey, you know, we're just starting to notice these things now because our sensors got better or because there's less stigma. It's like, no. Yeah, we know that there's more. And I want people like Eric and people like Sam and others who get involved who have the kind of like the capability because of their weight, because of the who they are as influencers, to turn around. And I do expect this from Eric, to be honest, to turn around and be like, we need real answers about this, because if this is true now, what about Roswell? What about all the other things? What about, you know, the 7 decades worth of cover up? What about Blue Book? And, you know, I really think that even though they're trying to manage this in a way that does seem to be skirting away from governmental culpability, I just don't see them being able to escape it. And quite frankly, as much as I support people like Lou and Chris, I ask people consistently, you should challenge the narrative, you know, support the players who are trying to put this out there, like support Chris and Lou, and, you know, because they've given us talking points and they've given us a blueprint that I can go to my family who've never researched this and go, look, this, and this. And they go, oh, there's, you know, something to this. So they've given us a profoundly important blueprint to start a discussion. But at the same time, they can't talk about stuff that's restricted because of their NDAs, their non-disclosure agreements. But we, as civilians, should consistently challenge, you know, this narrative that's coming out. You know, is it Chinese? Is it Russian? Like, it's a soft serve narrative that's being pushed. And personally, I don't like that. And I understand the necessity for it. But I feel like even though I understand the necessity for it, I should still be trying to challenge it in some way to push them even further. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we have to continually. I mean, that has to be until, you know, I think that's going to be a long-term game. But, you know, credit to Lou Elizondo and Christopher Mellon for talking about crash retrievals.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Number one, they're talking crash retrievals. They're talking, you know, Lou, you know, just showed a document the other day from 1948 nuclear facilities.
Yeah.
Which, you know, funny enough, that's from the citizens hearing as well.
Is it?
Yeah. During the part one nuclear incidents. But so they're talking about that. They can't hard on that. But Mellon also on Joe Rogan, he talked about
Department of Energy and.
Yeah. But he also talked about how the Condon report and the Robinson panel were meant to crush the subject and hide it. And Mellon straight out said that, you know, that from the beginning, they tried to quiet this up. You know, I think that it's going to be a long game with that. And
we
got to continuously do it. And that's why, you know, somebody got upset with me for talking about MJ-12. But, you know, again, I think that, you know, we have to continuously ask these questions.
Oh, you do. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Why would there not be a top secret classified program to look into the subject? And, you know, we learned from that Canadian gentleman, Wilbur Smith, that the UFO subject was more classified than the hydrogen bomb in the 1950s,
which was
the ultimate doomsday weapon.
Yeah.
How do you have something classified higher than the ultimate doomsday weapon? Well, there's got to be a good reason for it. And why would you not have a committee to investigate that?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Absolutely. And to be fair, like you were saying, Lou and Chris and Sean Cahill as well, you know, they are talking about the history. I mean, they're not talking about it so much on the mainstream media. They're talking about it in interviews with people like us and other people they've jumped on record with. But it's not necessarily them I've got really the issue with. It's more the structure they're representing, which is the US government and the, you know, the Navy and the Pentagon and the DOD. And the fact that they're just releasing these very, you know, kind of just bland kind of perspectives on this when we know that there's a deeper knowledge, you know.
Everybody gets it for them. I mean, like, once people realize that this is real, everybody that I've seen, they've reacted. None of them thinks that this is new. They're saying, okay, UFOs are real. So they're assuming that Roswell is real too.
Yeah.
It's something that we're going to have to continue by keeping the conversation there, you know, not shying away from the crash retrieval, which is the Holy Grail. And you have people like Eric Davis saying that, Roswell was legit. And Corso's story checked out, you know, with technology transfer. You know, when you have somebody like Eric Davis, who got into the New York Times talking about recovered off-world vehicles. We gotta keep pushing that. Yeah, big time. Yeah. Because the crash retrievals is the Holy Grail. If we have recovered technology, that stands to be one of the most important discoveries of this reality. I mean, nothing would end the questions more than, you know, recovered technology like that.
There also seemed to be an indication in your fantastic interview with Lou. There also seemed to be an indication from him of archaeological discoveries, because he was talking about finding a Boeing 747 in a pyramid, like in if you went into a pharaoh's tomb and you found a Boeing 747, like how would that fit with your worldview? And the way he said it was like, are you saying that people found something in a place it shouldn't have been a long time ago? And
he made two references.
Yeah.
Archaeological finds. First, he talked about the 747 being found in the tomb. And then he talked about the dagger.
The meteorite, right? Dagger, yeah.
Yeah. So I would not be surprised if there's something there. And, you know, I asked him just a few minutes before he said that. I asked him about the comment that I got from Eric Davis about crash and landed off-world vehicles. So that's an interesting correlation. And it's interesting that he went there and he said it, you know, twice. So yeah. I think there's something there. When are we going to get to that conversation?
Maybe the Smithsonian is actually sitting on loads of flying saucers that we don't know about.
Oh, they're not going to have it. I mean, if there were digs and they found something, it's at like Utah Proving Grounds, Wright Pat, or, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
If that's something I had and I was the U.S. government, I would want that in an underground facility.
Oh, for sure. No, I just meant like, you know, the Smithsonian's the guy, you know, this is the institute that's going out and doing the archaeological digs and stuff like that. Yeah. You know, they're the ones that are interested in preservation of historical culture and antiquity. So I was like, archaeologists came across this, you know.
In Tom DeLonge's second fiction book with A.J. Hartley, A Fire Within, you know, they're Reese. And there's a dig and they're trying to find this alien artifact, basically extraterrestrial artifact, whatever you want to call it. So I think I'm more convinced now that there's like technology like that seeded. I don't know if it's seeded or it's ancient, like, you know, we had ancient civilizations on this planet. Cause look, if the Earth is several billions of years old, you know, 4.6 billion years old or whatever, you know, who's to say that 100 million years ago, there wasn't some kind of other advanced civilization? We just don't know. We just don't know. You know, even whether they were from this planet or visiting, had an outpost here.
Yeah.
You know, these are going to be more serious conversations once we realize, you know, because, you know, once the UFO reality is acknowledged as genuine, true, other intelligence, everybody in their special fields, like archaeologists, have something new to look into. You know, linguists, every different field has something to contribute to this question.
Yeah, no, it'll be really great to see, you know, academics and scientists and people who are in that type of arena speculating about things like, you know, alien bases or, you know, what's on the moon, what's on Mars. Because, you know, so for so long, that's been relegated to what most normal citizens would think is weird, kooky, strange people on the internet that are putting red circles around objects on Mars and saying, see, look, there's a pattern here. And, you know, there's a lot of crazies in that kind of, you know, in this community. We know that. Yeah. But these types of ideas translating out into the mainstream, that would be fascinating to witness, like having actual people go, you know, maybe there are bases on the moon and Mars and, you know, like we need to know about this. And I'm looking forward to this discussion kind of permeating out and people kind of going, oh, my God, it's the same stuff that people have been talking about for years. But suddenly, suddenly the serious, sensible people are talking about it. So it's OK now.
Everything's on the table now. I mean,
really, everything's on the table.
Flip over every table and see what's under it, man.
Exactly.
But I did want to ask you, what are your thoughts on, and I don't mean this in like a necessarily negative way, but of course we're going to get there, the threat narrative.
So like, I mean, I teeter and I kind of pendulum across this, because like I don't see a direct threat narrative, and I feel like if there was this kind of intention for like a global agenda of perpetrating a threat, they're not doing a very good job, because Basically, only in America is this really kicking off. And like in this country, no one even knows that this is going on. I mean, it's just started because of, seriously, because of the because of the pending report and because of the IG going, like that started to kind of come out now in little bits and pieces. But if they're wanting the whole world to rally against an alien aggressor, they're not doing that really in my mind. And I've always seen it as, you know, the incursions over military sites and sensitive training ranges, that, you know, the shadowing of carrier strike groups into Middle Eastern theaters. This is all just language. This is linguistic tactics to kind of grease the wheels of bureaucracy, because these are the types of things that the government responds to, that the Department of Defense responds to, that, you know, a national security threat. And to an extent, it's true. I mean, there is an unknown, at least to some degree, that is making our military assets useless. And it's, you know, it can render our strategic nuclear capabilities as useless. Like, you know, there is, especially to a Department of Defense or anyone within the NATSEC world and the intelligence world, a tangible threat or a potential threat. And so, like, from that perspective, I get it. There is another side of me that thinks that there are inner sanctums of government that have a pretty good idea of what this stuff is and the kind of threat or potential of threat it represents. And I think that for the most part, it's considered benign, you know, if not a little weird and concerning to them. It just, you know, doesn't seem to fly very far on the radar in terms of a tangible threat. And so I can understand them saying potential threat and we're trying to figure it out. I just don't buy into a big global agenda to convince people that there's an alien threat. I could be wrong. I could be proven wrong. And I'll tell you what, if ships suddenly started turning up in the skies everywhere and everyone was panicking, I would lean more towards that being a false flag than, you know, the ETs or whatever these things are, because that seems very out of character for what the behaviors of these things seem to be like, which is very nuanced. So if there was going to be something that was really scary and overwhelming, I'd probably lean towards that being some sort of human operation. But until that day comes, and I hope it never does, I just don't really see, I don't really see it as a tangible issue. But I, because of my experiences, and you know this yourself, and especially, you know, recently, because I haven't been doing CE5 a lot, and a lot of it is because I just didn't want to trivialize it. I didn't want to go out there and be like, right, put on a light show, let me see stuff. So I, you know, I've tried to kind of like not do it as much, and I'll do it on special occasions. But when I went to see Kaz Clark and we had this CE5 and everyone was in a nice, you know, we were all in a lovely group. We had a barbecue. Everyone was in a good mood and it was just a lovely time. And these things turned up and did loads of lovely things. And like, you know, it was amazing. And it really did catalyze that thought in my head of like, I don't like looking at this and feeling scared or like a narrative. Like everything that I have personally experienced from this has come from a root of positivity. And so there's this balance in my head of like, yeah, there's a big universe. Maybe there are some things out there that don't hold our best interests, but there is something, I'm telling you now, there is something that really cares about us, that loves us, that is, you know, in some way wanting us to wake up to a higher level of reality, to a higher understanding of what we are as human beings. And I do believe that there is that side of this. And so I just can't believe that the government doesn't know that kind of stuff. Like, for, I've said this before, if a 26-year-old from the UK with no intelligence background has been able to make contact with these things in some way through peaceful methods, they've done it as well. If they haven't done it, that's insane. Like, why? How can me and you be having this conversation and having these experiences and these realizations if some people within that intelligence infrastructure haven't done that already? I mean, they've had remote viewing and Stargate and all of these different things that surround the idea of consciousness. So I just feel like it's kind of relatively disingenuous, the narrative that's coming out. It's disingenuous to an extent, but it's also a necessary evil because people are so uneducated. But then again, they're so uneducated because the government has stopped them from being informed. So it's a real issue of like, what is the most important thing that happens right now? I guess the most important thing that can happen is that people who aren't like us, who aren't deeply embedded in the community, get educated. And the best way I've seen myself, because I've used these talking points and they work, the best way to educate those people is 2017 New York Times ATIP incursions, nuclear, you know, all of that, because it wakes people up and they go, oh my God, the Department of Defense, the Navy, like, you know, all of this. And so that's, it's useful to that level, but you and I and so many people listening to this know that there's something deeper, and not just deeper in terms of secrecy, but deeper in terms of spirit, in terms of consciousness, in terms of something really profound. And like, and I just don't want to see that get pushed away. You know, so many people say, why are you trying to contact these things? We don't know what they are. It's like, well, in all honesty, I'm not scared about that. What, you know, I want to see these things. And like every time I've seen them, I haven't felt threatened. I haven't felt threatened at all. I mean, do you ever get afraid? I have had times where I've been outside and I've been like, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. Like, I feel a bit alone. And I trust my intuition at that point, and I usually go back inside. But have you ever had experiences where you're like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be doing this? Or have you been pretty consistent?
I had more, I guess you can say, jarring experiences when I was younger, and that's because I didn't know what was going on. And, right. At that point, I actually was scared, but I don't know if I can directly correlate that to the UFO phenomenon per se. But since I was older and I had experiences, I've questioned it and thought, hey, maybe should I be? But when I was having those, especially those experiences again, where I would have a direct lock on and I was connected to the intelligence in a very deep way, there's no questions in my mind about that. But again, you know, people could argue, oh, well, they're using their technology to subdue you in a sense, or manipulate you.
There's always a way to counter it back to something else, you know.
But I really do not feel that. And again, they're super advanced. Sure, they could do that. Do I think that's what's going on? I don't see the purpose for that. Why, you know, what would be their reasoning for the point to do that? You know, and to continuously visit and have these, you know, what I would call positive interactions, you know, even if they were somehow, you know, trying to negative manipulate me, if people want to think that, you know, I've only had this enrich my life and lead me down a more positive road in my life. So if whatever they're doing, you know, it hasn't been harmful for me, even in retrospect, looking at how it all unfolded, it's only, you know, helped me grow.
Same. And then obviously there is that contrast of people who say they got abducted, they had trauma, they had these, and I've never had those experiences. So I don't want to, you know, I totally believe that people have had traumatic experiences, right. And I don't want to take away from that, but there is something, you know, it's not just one thing. There is this element of what seems to be a positive force, but I'm sure that there's a counter to that. I'm sure there is something else out there. But when you genuinely, truly, intentionally engage in this with love, and people might cringe, you know, so obviously you've got your platform, your demographic, your audience understand this kind of stuff for the most part. Yeah, so I know that most of them will be nodding their heads, but there'll be a few people who go, ugh. But you know, when you ground yourself in love, in positivity, in a real kind of innocent attempt to reach out and say, hey, look, is there anything out there that feels the way I feel, that, you know, like thinks the way I think about life and the universe? And if there is, can you say hello to me? Like in some way, modeling that type
absolutely.
Of, and that when they respond to you, and when it's benign or in some ways benevolent, you know, I just don't know how to interpret that as, oh, they're manipulating you, they're tricking you. Like, you know, I just don't see that. And I could be a naive human, but I don't see that threat.
Yeah. And you know what, again, I'm open to that being investigated. Let's find the answers. Yeah, yeah. Again, I don't want to discount anybody's negative experiences. You know, I don't doubt that there have been experiences like that, but it just hasn't been my experience. Yeah. Maybe it's a different intelligence that I'm interacting with. I don't have the answer to that. And I don't think everybody should necessarily proclaim to have the answers as far as, oh, well, you know, it's the Greys and they're here to do this, or the Pleiadians and they're here all love and light. You know, we're going to eventually find out. But with the CE5, it's for me, it's been positive. And what you talk about, the love aspect, I'm actually planning to do a video on that. And that's something in Buddhism is called metta, M-E-T-T-A. And that's a practice in Buddhism. And it's called love. Metta means loving kindness. But like a more kind of Western way to look at that phrase, without people being turned off, I guess you can say, is it also means like well wishing, you know, wishing well towards others, you know, even to the universe itself, you know. So you're projecting that state, and that's literally a practice in Eastern traditions called metta. And I include that in my practice. And I think actually that is the most powerful way to make contact.
Yeah.
You know, forget about the CE5 protocols. Yeah, they work. They're a great starting point. They're like training wheels to get you on the right path to, you know, get your feet wet. But the practice of like metta, where you're projecting positive intentions and, you know, contact with other sentient intelligences throughout the cosmos or, you know, multiverse, that's one of the most profound ways to go about it. And I think I've had the most enriching experiences doing that.
Well, I've never done this. Sorry, you were going to say something else.
No, I was going to say that's the same thing you're saying. You know, you can call it love, you can call it metta, positive intentions, and even a transcendental version of that too is called bodhicitta. And that's like the heart mind, the awakening of the heart mind, which really means the work that you're doing to uplift all conscious beings in the universe. And that's a very powerful approach to it too.
Well, I think because I've never done Stephen Greer's protocols. So I think the most closely attributed one would be the metta, which I didn't know about in terms of that terminology, but like, that's pretty much what I've been doing from the get go. And that's what stimulated me a lot was trying to talk to people and go, look, it's, you know, Stephen Greer is great. And he's making this contact, but his protocols aren't the only protocols. And, you know, I've done it very simplistically, just calm state of mind, controlled breathing, and then very coherent thoughts that are kind of, I guess you could say, almost charged with emotions. So like I've got a thought, which is the intention of contact, but then I charge that thought and that intention with love and positivity and, you know, kind of imagine that I'm sending it out, oscillating it out of my mind. And that's kind of, that's it. That's all I was, people always say, like someone's, when I said that I'd had these, you know, great experiences with Kaz, the other day, someone was like, oh, so what protocols do you guys use? And I was like, if having a barbecue with a bunch of people and feeling happy, that's the protocol. Like, you know, we were just happy and we wanted to have contact and it happened. Like, you know, and so you don't need to overcomplicate it with all of these different methods and protocols. And I think that's one issue that I have with Stephen Greer is just the kind of overcomplication of it. It's almost akin to the, you know, the Catholics speaking in Latin so that the peasants didn't know exactly what was being said to them. So it makes it more mysterious and you have to do all these different steps. And I
was going to say, I think for the time he was trying to set it up in like a scientific framework. So I think the CE5 protocols for the time served its purpose.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was kind of like, if you have something that looks like very technical, people are going to kind of be taken by that and say, okay, there's a process to this. I can do it, you know? And I think it was important for getting it to where it is now. So
that's really true, actually. No, that's really true because it's not ambiguous. It's refined and it's like, okay, I can do these steps and it'll work.
It's a scientific framework and there's a whole process to it. And of course, you know, if I follow this, it's going to work, you know, it's a process that you have that you're going to believe in. You know, if 5 years ago, if I told you, try this, or maybe not you, maybe somebody else, you know what I mean? Like, or just sit outside and project love and to connect with other intelligent beings. You know, most people are going to say, okay, this guy's kind of a little, this guy needs to go, you know, eat another brownie or you know, drop some acid. But somebody says, no, listen, this is the way to do it. You got a calm state of mind, meditation, you know, project your intention or remote view, visualize that you're, you know, so it's a process that people can believe in and think, oh, like, okay, I understand. Yeah. I see how that makes sense. You know, so I think they're useful in that way. Again, but it's not going to be the best way for everybody to do it.
Yeah. But
I think it has a certain appeal and, you know, a technical aspect where people can can identify with, okay, there's a process that I'm doing that's leading to a result.
Well, it's technical, but also as human beings, you know, by nature, we're ritualistic, and there is like a level of kind of steps being put in place. And, you know, if I put these here and do it this way, and I put this here and do it this way, I'll get a specific result. And we've been doing that for, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years through different practices. So I get that. I definitely understand that. And like you said, just hearing someone say, just sit down and open your mind, and like, that's very abstract. It's not like,
I don't know. But this guy is, you know, just sit down over here and speak to the extraterrestrials. They're going to say, okay, whatever, dude.
Yeah.
You know, and it's
that
just
has,
like,
but that has been it for me. That has been the way I did it. Very simple.
Yeah. Approach. And, you know, for some people, that'll work. But I think the majority of people, if they feel that there's a technical process involved, you're going to get a result based on that process. And I'll tell you, even the same thing with meditation, right? It appeals to personalities, right? And people's affinities. Like, all you literally need to do for meditation is sit and be still. That's it. And Ramana Maharshi, this was his approach to teaching, but he realized that people weren't getting it. So he would say, use a mantra. So recite this mantra. Every time you start to fade away, come back to the mantra. And it's a single pointed concentration. So, you know, do that and keep doing that. You know, other things is all these complicated pranayamas. Oh, do this, which they work. These different pranayamas work, but there's nothing magical about them. They get your attention and awareness to focus on one thing until you can transcend that, until you can transcend the object of meditation. And again, there's all these different meditation systems, and they eventually get you to the same place. You know,
one interesting, I know we're probably running out of time, but one really interesting thing that my buddy Jean-Luc, who people might know as Jean-Luc Infini on Twitter, we were talking about this in the car, about like kind of different states of meditation, or how to translate the idea or benefits of that to people that don't kind of gel with spirituality. And he said that there was I can't remember the specifics, but there was a kind of a military practice for soldiers, essentially to get them to, reduce their level of fear or increase their level of endurance or anything like that. And it was essentially a mantra, but it was more adaptable to a soldier. And it was quite literally, I'm a rubber ducky and I will not quit. So they would say in their mind, I'm a rubber ducky and I will not quit. I'm a rubber ducky and I will not. And that was the soldier mantra to actually get them to, you know, run another 10 miles or keep going up this hill or whatever it was, or, you know, reduce the pain in an injury. And I, when he said this, I was like, oh, wow, that's someone in the military understands the abilities of consciousness, and they understand that people need it to be translated in certain ways. So instead of saying, you know, like, go om, they're literally saying like, right, soldier, listen, you're a rubber ducky and you will not quit. You know, you keep saying that over in your head. And he's like, yes, sir. You know, and it's just, how do you translate it? Because everyone's different. Everyone has different ways of embracing this.
And that's why you have all these different meditation systems. And that exactly. Right there, that's when you say a mantra internally in your head and keep coming back to it, that's all that transcendental meditation is. They say they give you a special mantra for transcendental meditation, and that's your mantra. But it was kind of found out that there was, I don't want to say a scam, but there was a way that they were giving everybody a mantra, and it wasn't just unique to them. It was based on their birthday and stuff. Their birthday, they give some information, and it could have been defined by Vedic astrology. I'm not sure, but all transcendental meditation is an internal mantra, period.
Yeah.
You know, and again, there's all these, and they're all useful. I've experimented with so many different meditations, and I really like pranayama just because I'm a psycho, whatever, physical. I like mind body because I work out a lot, and I've developed the ability to connect mind and body through repetitive practice. And so pranayama, there's a physical feeling component to it, so it works great for me, you know. But I don't always use it. There's all these different methods to transcend and get to special or altered states of awareness. So you know, again, all these different approaches, and there are what is it like? The Western Buddhism movement has very like Sam Harris. Sam Harris is an atheist, and you know he does his own way of teaching. Basically, it's Buddhist meditation. I don't know if he calls it that, but it's more or less that's what it is. You know, he did quite a few Vipassana retreats, which is the meditation of the Buddha is the Vipassana insight meditation. Which a few Westerners brought over, and it's pretty popular. But there's a version of it, I forget what it's called. It's like mindfulness based stress reduction.
Okay.
And they use that terminology so they can introduce it into the medical fields. So like you could, you know, employ that basically in different treatments, because it's not meditation, it's mindfulness based stress reduction, you know, but it's the same thing. It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Vipassana. Yeah. So, there you go. But yeah, just so we're getting to the end here. So, you know, excellent talk, man. It's been a pleasure actually getting to sit down and talk to you face to face. Great to see your eyebrows.
No, right. Yeah.
But what is like a message that you'd like to leave the viewers with?
Oh man, you made me think on the fly of some profound message. But I guess my message would be, in terms of ufology, support the players, but challenge the narrative. So, you know, use the blueprint that we've been given from 2017 to talk to people outside of the UFO community, people in your family, friends, whoever, and help them realize that there's actionability to the UFO conversation by, you know, talking about what's been going on in the modern emerging mainstream narrative. But at the same time, once they've integrated that into their understanding, if they're more curious, then dive deeper and try and get them to understand that there is a lot more to this than just what is coming out in the news. So I think that's one issue. And another, just on a personal level for people, you know, just try and this is a very chaotic time we're living in. Try and do as much good as you can, even if it's just for yourself. Like, you have to do good for yourself to do good for others. So meditation is always an important thing to try and incorporate into someone's life in any way that's attributable. And that's, I'm saying that to myself as much as to you guys, because, you know, my discipline wavers, and I find that meditation in whichever way works for you, it can be a very, very profound tool for balancing your life on a day-to-day basis. And it can also then, if you, you know, really get into it and you find that you're finding some benefit from it, it can then lead to you having contact scenarios if you move that intention and that meditatory state towards that goal. So when it comes to the modern stuff, support the players, challenge the narrative. When it comes to personal things, just try and work on your own development, your own personal spiritual development, if that's what you want to do. And if you want to make contact and you want to try and do these types of things that me and James have been talking about, then my best recommendation is the clearing of your mind, the resetting of that crazy, chattery monkey mind that's in your brain. And from that point, you should be able to, you know, direct it towards that intention of making contact, because this stuff is real. We're not crazy people. We have seen what we're telling you we've seen, and we want people to see it as well. And that's why I started what I'm doing. And I think that's why, you know, James is doing what he's doing. It's called engaging the phenomenon for a reason. We want to engage with this phenomenon and hopefully increase our own apertures and parameters. And alongside that, help you guys do the same.
Absolutely. And just so you know, a good example of the mind body state is like rock climbing.
Right.
That puts you into mind body.
I didn't say it, but I was going to ask if you do it. And that was actually one of the first things that put me into what I would consider a meditative state was rock climbing, because you cannot focus on anything other than what's right in front of you at the time, where your hand is, where your foot is, where your body weight is. And so, yeah, when it comes to body, mind, meditation.
That's mindfulness practice.
Yeah, and absolutely.
And that state of awareness is called mind-body awareness. And it's a powerful insight stage. So let me tell you, even I used to do, you know, when I'm like working out, or if I'm doing like Qigong or any kind of yoga or anything like that, you can actually do like mini contact cycles while you're rock climbing, kind of like just in your subtle awareness while you're doing the rock climbing, just have that intention, you know, and put it out there while you're doing it. And I'd like leave the gym or whatever, and boom, as soon as I get home or outside, there's like an object there and it's, you know, interacting because that's such a powerful state.
Well, there we go then, guys. So do rock climbing, because not only do you get, you know, a meditation state, but you also get biceps. So you get strong in body and strong in mind, and that can help you have contact. So yeah, I think that's a good message for sure.
Yeah. Body, mind, and spirit.
Body, mind, and spirit.
Just where can people find your work?
Oh, so yeah, you can find me on YouTube. You should hopefully, if YouTube's being kind to me on the search lists, if you just type in Project Unity, it should pop up. On Twitter, it's basically really just YouTube and Twitter. And on Twitter, I'm at the Project Unity. So that's basically my two platforms. You can also email me if you want to, you know, talk about your experiences, or if you want to recommend, you know, an interview or anything like that. And that's projectunitycontact@gmail.com. So they're the ways in which I interact, and they're the ways in which you can interact with me. And I just want to say thank you again, James, for having me on. I'm sure this is going to be the first of many one-on-one discussions with us, because there's a good energy between us. We both have very similar ways of approaching the issue of UFOs and the issue of this phenomena. And it's a pleasure to be here talking shop with you, man.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And I'm going to have all your links in the description for people
Much
who
obliged.
Are watching on YouTube. So you can find all Jay's stuff down in the description. There you go. Down. I'm waiting for the eyebrows to move. So great talk.
It is a phenomenon in of itself, my eyebrows.
Yeah, we're going to come up with a terminology for that, man.
I'm telling you, it's eyebrows. It's eyebrows. Yeah, that's what everyone calls it. In my Premiere live chats, it is known. People look for eyebrows. I might even make a t-shirt that says eyebrows on it.
That would be hilarious. I'd love to see that. All right, great talking to you, Jay. I'll talk to you soon.
Likewise. You take care of yourself.
Take care, man.